Welcome to Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole.
Hi, I'm Brandon Mole. I'm a number one New York Times bestselling author of a bunch of fantasy series like the Fablehaven series and many more.
And I'm Jason Conforto. I'm a filmmaker, a podcaster, and game designer. In this podcast, we're excited to share our love for story and our passion to create.
We hope to share a bunch of experiences and lessons learned over a lifetime in creative fields.
All right, Allie, thanks for joining us again on another episode of Mulling It Over.
I'm excited to be here. Can't wait for this part.
Yeah. So today we're going to get into the nitty gritty of writing. We really wanted to hear a little bit about your process, how do you tackle the project, how you break it up, where you do plotting and that kind of stuff. So typically, what does it look like for you when you jump into starting a new project?
So usually it looks like I have an idea, and the idea comes to me often in the form of, oh, there's this character and they're doing this thing. So for Matched, it was, there's a character and she's on the way to find out who she's supposed to marry. Why? You know, and then I start asking the questions around that. Like, I didn't know when I started Matched, I thought, is this like a historical novel? Is this a, and then I settled on dystopian. Is this a current day novel set in a different country? I abandoned that really quick because I thought.
So you had a setup before you even had a genre.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah, I have a character and she's on this train and it's still a train, but I didn't know what era the train was in. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
she was in motion, going to this thing, but then I didn't know the rest of it. So then I start, and that's always how it is. So for my most recent young adult novel, which is called The Only Girl in Town, I knew there was a girl who came out of the forest from a hike and her entire town had disappeared. Like the people, the place is still there, the houses are still there, but nobody else is there anymore. And then I think, why? You know, I don't know where they went. I don't know why they went. I don't know how they went. I don't know how long they've been gone. You know, and I just start asking all the questions around the character doing the thing.
Yeah, I love that description of asking questions, right? It's more than plotting. It's like you have to get in there to go, why this, why that, why? Mm-hmm. Brandon, do you spend a lot of time in that why, or do you not use that question model?
No, I ask these kind of things all the time. Yeah. But like, my entry point is usually different from what Allie's describing. Like my entry point will be more like thinking up a world, or sometimes thinking up like I'll have certain characters that I want to see have certain moments. Like I'm not like starting at a start and then building. I'm kind of like looking kind of globally and thinking about like what's a really interesting type of magic? What's a really interesting world to be in? And if I'm in this world, what would be awesome stuff to see happen in that world? So like I'm kind of looking for big, cool moments that I can then start asking the questions of, okay, so how does this fit together? Like if I want to see some of these moments, who are these people and how did that start? And what connects these moments? And some of that is in the writing, right? But like for me, it's kind of like I'm looking at, I think of it as like in my head, in my daydreams, I build a skeleton and then I go in my writing and put meat on the skeleton. Right. And figure out how to connect all those bones together or whatever. Right. Like that's, I mean, speaking broadly, that's how I attack it. But that's one of the interesting things about writing is there's so many ways, so many entry points. Like Candy Shop War, the first thing I had was a title.
Yeah. Oh.
The first thing I had was, I want to write a book called The Candy Shop War.
Yeah.
You know,
because well, that's like, a great title.
I was like, because that sounds awesome. You know, and I was like, so what's that war all about? You know, like kind of silly. But and like for Fablehaven, it was just a place.
Yeah.
What if there was secret wildlife parks for magical creatures? I was like, that's a fun place to tell a story. And then like, well, so who would discover this place? You know, and then I go into the questions, right?
So Allie, how far in the process, how many of these questions do you have to answer? Because before you even write, you've got to do a pitch, right, to your agent and publishers and stuff, right? So how deep do you go?
Or do you?
Yeah.
Like are you writing before you're pitching? Like are you coming to them with something written or half written or like how much of that? Yeah.
It's varied. And I have to say, it remains, and I think will forever, I think Fablehaven, that idea, the magical creature sanctuary, is genius. Like, that resonated with everyone. That was so brilliant. And that'll be a classic forever. So I just have to give you a hot tip for that, because it blows me away every time I think of it. I'm like, that's so good. That's like J.K. Rowling, Harry Potter idea level good.
Yeah,
it's so good. But so it's been different. Like, with Matched, I'd written the whole book. And then with books 2 and 3, they bought books 2 and 3, and I had not written them. Yeah. And so, it really does vary pretty wildly. The only time I've sold a book on proposal, I guess I sold Matched 2 and 3 on proposal, mm-hmm. in the sense that they'd read Matched 1. But,
yeah,
But was The Unwedding. Like, I had 100 pages of it, though. I still had 100 pages of the book. And then they bought that. So it's just, it does. It really varies. It comes together so messily when you write this way. Brandon, I think you're probably a tidier plotter. But for me, I'm like asking these questions. But I write all the time when I'm asking the questions, because if I sit down and try to plot, I lose the excitement. So I'm just writing scenes, ideas, chapters. It's this giant mess. But I'm keeping a running outline of what scenes I've written, what ideas I've had, so that I can go and
So you really are discovering the plot as you write it. And at what
it's
point...
It's a nightmare. I do not recommend.
So messy. I feel like the biggest issue with that would be, what's the climax? What's the ending? How soon in the process do you find the climax?
So that's interesting. So it is messy and it is crazy, but usually about 25, 30 pages into writing, I know the end.
Okay.
And it may be like, so readers, I'm holding up a hand here and then putting a hand slightly next to it. Like, I think it's going to end here, this hand, and it ends here, like slightly far away in a different spot than where I had my original thought, but it's adjacent.
Yeah.
Like the book will evolve, but I know...
The target's
I know
close.
The climax. Yeah, I do.
So it sounds to me like when you write those first 25 or 30 pages, you build a ramp. And then you're like, if I jump my motorcycle off this ramp.
I should clear.
It's going to probably land somewhere over there on the other side of the river. And like, and a little bit, right? And
yeah, like, I love that. Actually, that's exactly what it feels like.
Because you're like, I've got enough here where I can kind of see the trajectory this is taking, right? Right?
Yeah.
And splashing in the river could be exciting for some
folks.
It could
be fun. Yeah.
We'll see how it lands.
We'll see how we land. Yeah, exactly.
Now, how is that different for like series plotting? How much do you do with your series plotting versus an individual book plotting?
With the series, so this is interesting, I think, if you're a book nerd. They bought they bought books 2 and 3, and they knew book 2 would be a matched book, but I hadn't written it yet, so I didn't know if I would need a book 3.
Okay.
So they said book 3 can be anything you want. And about 50 pages into book 2, I said it will be a book 3.
Okay.
I knew I wasn't going to.
You knew the end of book 2 and 3.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could see the beats of it exactly. And that's different because I know the characters already. I know the world already. Mm-hmm. And I know where they are in the journeys I have envisioned for them. And so I can see how long it's going to take.
And when you wrote Matched 1, what was your, when you ended that process, were you thinking the sequel at all, or was this just a contained story? What was your thoughts there?
I really hoped someone would buy it.
Yeah.
Because nobody, that was my first foray into national market publishing.
Right.
So I wrote it. I thought it had like kind of a contained but open-ended ending.
Right.
And now looking back, I think it's a total cliffhanger.
Okay.
But at the time, I thought I had written this.
You thought it was all buttoned up.
Well, I thought it was partially buttoned up, but with openings. The publisher love it, they could say, why don't you do more? But yeah, I think at the time I thought it was more buttoned up than I think it actually is now that I look back.
Which ended up being a good thing.
Yeah.
But you weren't thinking plot lines for book.
I was. Okay, I had lots of ideas for book 2. I really hoped I'd get to write it. Yeah.
Yeah. What about you, Brandon? How is plotting a one-off different than, and most of your stuff is series, so I know you're thinking series, but how is a plotting different from an individual book versus a series?
Yeah, I mean, look, I haven't done a ton of individual books. I wrote Candy Shop Board to be just one book. Like, I wasn't planning on that being a series. That one became a series as kids asked for a series, literally. but like, And so on that one, it was like, yeah, just think through this. And then once this is done, this is done. For Fablehaven, I had a hope it would be a series. So I was trying to do what Allie just described. And I was trying to like end the story, but leave some mystery, you know, like where it could continue. And Shadow Mountain was very adamant that like, this might be just one book, you know, like, right, enough right, where right, I was right. like, okay, well, I better be careful then, you know? But like when I'm planning a series, it's yeah. I mean, I'm trying so hard to see really cool beats deep in the series so I can do the setups for them. You know what yeah. I mean? Like yeah, that's yeah. that's the main thing is like, it's a little bit like that. All you have is that ramp. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And you're trying to see like when it's a series, it's a little bit like, what if I was going to try to jump my motorcycle and like hit a bunch of stuff, like a bunch of ricochets,
right.
Yeah, you know,
and like bounce here and bounce there, like I'm trying to jump the river, and then it's going to turn into like a, what are those, like in Goonies, the contraption thing called like Rube Goldberg?
Rube Goldberg machine.
It's like a mix between jumping the rope, jumping the river into a Rube Goldberg machine. I'm trying to see like, okay, there should probably be a chicken that'll lay an egg when the balloon pops, and that'll go down the ramp, and that'll hit a button that'll set up. Like you're trying to see all these cause and effects, right?
Right.
So like, and you don't have to see it in all its minutia, but you want to see enough cool beats where you can lay the groundwork and the setups. Because to me, I really like if there's a setup in book one that pays off like in book four. And you're like, who is this mastermind? Who is this devious guy who was like thinking that far ahead?
Well, let's talk about that real quick, because you are starting a new series, the Forbidden Mountain, the Guardian series, right?
Yeah.
And you know how many books this is going to be. How much plotting have you done in the books? You know the climax of your last book. Do you know where you're going towards? Not that you're locked into that, because there's some discovery that happens, but where are you in this process right now?
So on the three books in the Guardian series, and the book one is written, and book one comes out in April, and book two is what I'm writing right now. Mm-hmm. And like I see almost all the big beats, I think.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I've got a lot of big beats. I'm taking it into a place where not a lot of people have seen a lot quite like this, because I read enough to know that not a lot of people will have seen something quite like this. And so it's very exciting to me. And it's also very scary, because it's like, I've got a complicated equation in my head of beats, and I'm like, okay, I hope I can do this. Cause like it's, this is pushing me right to my limit on like the complexity of the beats I see. And so I'm like, okay, little by little, let's now connect all the dots. And like, that's what I'm doing in book two, connect all the dots. Like this is my, it is the kind of book where I'm breaking each of the books into parts. It's like book one's long. It's like book one is like as long as my book five. It's not Sanderson long, but it's, but it's as long as Brandon Mole gets about, you know, it's like my book fives of my longest books. Right. And like, you know, so 550 pages, something like that in book one, which is not what everybody wants. Like the publishers are like, really that long?
And this is your introduction. Yeah.
This is my big one. Like, this is my big
trilogy. You need this, guys. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like, it's a, it's right now. I broke it into parts, because like book one will have part one, part two, part three. Book two will be part four, part five, part like, this is really one big story. Like these three books are one big story, kind of Lord of the Rings-esque. Like it's one big story where I'm trying to have each book have some completeness, but it's definitely part of one big journey. Right. And so,
which is cool that you can tackle a project like this. Cause
I think every
reader wants to believe that's how all authors handle series, right? Where they have this master vision, and instead of just kind of making it up as it goes along.
And look,
so
here's the funny thing: you can improvise a whole long series like this, and it can read as though you had planned it all, as long as you connect all your dots smart. You know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And like the thing that Allie was describing about she will write a bunch of messy stuff early on is very equivalent to my messy daydreaming early on. She's just putting it on paper.
Yeah.
But that same kind of messiness exists in me sorting to try to find the beats. And like, I could do that sorting with pen to paper too. and it would be, then I would be drafting to find it. But instead I'm like trying to do the math in my head, as long as I can until I start drafting. Yeah.
Allie, would you mind just talking about, you wrote a murder mystery, right? And just talk to me about how fun it was to plot that. Cause I assume plotting a murder mystery is a very different beast than plotting any other genre. So what was that like for you doing that one?
That was definitely challenging. And I'm actually listening to Brandon a lot and thinking about what he's been saying and how he plots. Because I think one of the things that you do so well, and it's a different genre, but the rules still apply, is when I'm reading a Brandon Mole book, I'm never going to feel like it's a deus ex machina, right? Like, I'm not going to be like, this came out of nowhere.
Right.
I'm going to be like so surprised and delighted and thrilled, and I would never have thought of this, but it's going to make sense. He will have, I call it seeding it, mm-hmm. Like you're scattering seeds like Johnny Appleseed or something. He will have seeded it somewhere.
I am trying so hard. Like, that is my goal. Yeah. I'm trying so hard.
As a reader, and I love that in a story. So with a murder mystery, you're trying to do the same thing, mm-hmm. right? You want people to think anyone could be the murderer. So you have to give them, not anyone, but you don't want them to think, oh, it's so obvious that this is the murderer.
You want to have multiple suspects. Right?
Yeah, multiple suspects that all have to make sense, but not be too obvious.
Right.
And so that I thought about a lot. And I thought about, where does the twist happen? And then where does the follow-up twist happen? And then where does the follow-up, you know, because they also can't just be one twist. And so I thought about that a lot with pacing. And I knew who the possible murderers were, but I had to write to the end of the first draft. This sounds weird, but this always happens. I have to know who the characters are before I know what they'll do.
Right.
So I had to get to the end of the first draft to
before
be like,
you found out who the killer was.
Yeah, before I was like, oh, you're the killer.
You were the detective the whole time.
Yeah. And that's like a draft zero, right?
Sure.
Like that's just the author telling themselves the story first.
That's awesome to hear, though, that you set out writing this book, not even knowing who the killer was. I wonder how common that is.
I felt better. I will not out her, but I was speaking to an extremely successful thriller author, and she said, oh, I never know.
Yeah.
Until I've written the first draft. And I thought, oh, thank goodness.
Yeah.
That gives me permission to use my process, which is I don't know what my people will do until I know them. And that always takes the first full draft. So frustrating.
That's cool to hear.
No, it's a really useful way to think of it. It
seems like the right process, right?
There's a lot of ways to do this, like Brandon was saying. Yeah. For whatever reason, that's kind of
I guess right and wrong are not the right words to use.
The words would be, that's a useful way to do it. That's a workable way to do it.
Smart way. That way makes
sense for the way.
How is that different from plotting other books that you've done?
Well, the others, it's actually not that different in the sense that it's the characters that I'm learning about. Setting comes to me pretty quickly soon mm-hmm. after that. I need to anchor them somewhere. And so that was similar. I knew pretty early on, oh, this is Big Sur. And then the setting informs the story. And Big Sur, it has all these luxury resorts. And also they get mudslides. And so they're helicoptering people out of these luxury resorts. So it made sense to me, like, this is a place where I could have a locked door mystery. Only the people can't leave the resort. Someone's dead. They have to figure it out. So the setting comes along pretty soon after too. Like, I don't know.
Why Big Sur? Are you familiar with it?
Yeah. So I went there a couple of times and it's gorgeous. It's so, so pretty. And also they had just had a mudslide, so we couldn't get to where we wanted to go.
funny how that happened.
Yeah. So I mean, we still saw some great
stuff. Did they ever find the body?
No.
But that is fun that there were some real life circumstances where it sparked your creative side and you said, you know what?
Yeah.
I could take this place and these circumstances, great background for a murder mystery. Right.
Yeah. Cause I had the idea for the murder mystery. I thought, where should I? And it came fast. I was like, mm-hmm. oh, that'd be so fun. Cause I was writing it during COVID too. And I thought, where do I want to go in my brain?
Yeah.
Like, I want to go to Big Sur.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fun. So talk about when you're, I'm understanding now that you are using that first draft to get acquainted with your characters, mm-hmm. to get your story and your setting established. And then you're looking at that draft and what choices do you make, or what what's your next step after draft zero? Because this is not something I relate to directly. Like the closest thing to me is like, that's after I've done my mental math, I do draft one. But what are you looking at in draft zero to inform draft one? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm blown away that you can keep that you can do that mental math. Like you're saying, my brain does not work that way. Like I have to put it down to do the formula, not the formula, but like run it through the problem. Does that make sense? And yeah, you can do it in your head. And I think that's so cool and interesting.
It's like a show your work thing. The reason I can do it in my head is there's something broken about my head.
No.
In a beautiful way. Like where, like I don't know how to turn off the daydreaming side of my brain. And so I live in that place a lot.
Yeah.
And so like, it's sort of like watching a movie 100 times. That's why I don't forget it. Like for some reason, I loop on the story. But go on.
And if you do forget it, that's just a sign that
if I do forget it, I just assume I was supposed to forget it. Like the cool stuff will stick, the boring stuff will fade away, and I just kind of loop on the story like I'm watching a movie over and over. That's my draft zero.
I love that. Well, and I'm going to throw this right back at you. There's no right or wrong, right? There's just ways to do it.
Sure.
And your
exactly
way
is
so cool.
For some reason, something about that works for me for my draft zero. But back to this, when you are looking at your draft zero, what are you thinking about as you look at draft zero?
So I also keep like a big board of post-its on the side while I'm doing this messy draft zero.
Yeah.
And it's very basic beginning level stuff like plot, characters, and so I'll start adding those post-its in and moving them around like, oh, now they're doing this here. This character has this motivations, mm-hmm. themes. I don't set out to write a book with a theme. I'm not trying to be didactic, but I'm like, oh, like loss is coming up a lot.
This is what's emerging.
Yeah. What themes are coming
clearly
up?
This is going to be a theme in the book. So I'll have all that stuff. And then I'll look at that and I'll look at the document. And now that I know my people, I can go back and go into the scene and say, okay, what would they do here? What would they actually do? What furthers the plot? What furthers these themes in a way that I'm already doing? So plot, I'm making it sound like plot isn't important to me. It's just that the characters come first, but plot is so important to me. So it's a lot of plot work. Yeah. It's a lot of, this is not adding up. This is not making sense because I didn't know this yet. So how do I bring that into line?
Well, and is some of it like taking what you have and saying, okay, now I see who Professor Plum is.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to heighten him and push him into the exact space I see for him. Like, or are they already behaving like themselves pretty much?
They are a little bit, but it's so much different once I've been through the first draft.
It's a little of both then.
Yeah, exactly.
They've kind of become themselves during the first draft, and then you're double checking it as you move forward. So, yeah. Okay, now that I know who this person is, let's make sure it tracks throughout the story.
Do they usually all click into place in that first draft?
Yeah, they do.
By the end, you know who all of them are. Mm-hmm. And do you have something where can you tell when you know a character? What is that like? Is it like instantaneous? Like, oh, they just did that. Now I understand them.
That's exactly what it is. It goes from me thinking, what would they do, to them just doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then I'm like, oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I got them.
That make sense? Like, do you have that happen too with your characters?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like sometimes, like the thing that Jason's asking about, sometimes there'll be a certain choice a character makes or a certain thing that they do, where just that one thing, you're like, oh, now I see them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like sometimes you're like, oh, that typifies who I want them to be. That typifies who they seem like. Uh-huh. And now I can use that to inform the rest.
Yes. Right. Yeah, exactly.
And if that happens late in the process, that means you just have to start back and make sure that character's there the whole time.
Yep, exactly.
And that's the beautiful thing about having not shared the story yet. Is that no one else knows anything.
Right.
And so you can go back and do whatever you want. The thing that I find a little tricky for myself is I have a hard time not getting married to certain moments. And so I have to sometimes find how to unmarry myself, because often when I can kind of step back far enough, I can see a better way to do it if I let myself, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that's always like that push and pull is a tough one for me.
Yeah, that whole kill your darlings thing is real.
It's hard to... Like little things that you kind of like, but you're like, wait, but what if I see something that serves everything better?
Is this still serving the story?
Yeah. How many drafts do you typically go through?
So many.
Yeah, are you a ton?
Yeah.
What does that look like? 6, 13?
I mean, it varies with the books. Yeah. So, but it's, I mean, before I even send it to my agent, it's probably 4 or 5.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it just has to be.
And then after agent, it's several more.
Yeah.
And I'm like that too. I mean, it's at least that for me, probably. Like as far as going over and over.
Oh, that's encouraging to hear. Yeah, actually, like very encouraging. Yeah,
like just not having a draft zero does not mean I'm doing I'm doing multiple drafts every time. Okay, that's part of the drill.
And at what point do you start introducing alpha readers and beta readers and getting that type of feedback?
Or do you?
I do it less and less because I trust my agent, my editor so much. But I still do it for sure. But it's kind of around draft 2 or 3.
Okay.
Usually. Yeah.
So sometimes even before the agents.
Yeah,
get
for
it.
Sure. Yeah. I want that feedback before I send it to my agent usually.
And what do you look for? How do you use your beta readers at their best? Like how do you maximize what you get out of them?
Well, I'm asking about like plot and character. I'm asking about plot most of all because I worry that since I'm so focused on character and setting, that plot is not like the story has to make sense.
Right.
You don't care if it's a character you love wandering around doing things that don't make sense. So I'm usually asking for plot first read. Yeah. First beta or alpha beta read. And then after that, it's like, do their motivations add up? Do you buy into them? And that, you know, that has some overlap and goes hand in hand. But yeah.
And have you been using the same readers for years? Are you finding new ones or what's your...
Both. Yeah, yeah. I find new ones. And especially as I was moving into this category of adult murder mystery, then I'm asking friends I know who write adult murder mysteries, which are different than the friends sometimes not, like that are writing the other stuff. So yeah, but one I always have is Andy Ellis, who is a young adult and middle grade author here in Utah, who's fantastic. And she has the double-edged sword of being a fantastic writer and a brilliant teacher. She's taught at BYU for 20-something years, so I'm like, she has the skills to, like, teach me what the crap I'm doing.
So you're getting, like, professional feedback before sending it to the
Yeah, she's my friend, but that's a really... She's my friend, but she's a professional, and that's a lucky thing. Yeah.
Do you return that? Do you read a lot of other... Yeah. Tell me about your process with that. When I say that, I mean when... How do you feel you're the most helpful when you read somebody else's book and give them notes?
I think I played like when I'm writing. So Andy, for example, I'll just use her as my, but she has insane voice. So I will not touch her voice unless I feel very strongly. So that's her strength.
Yeah.
And then I'll try to look at my strengths, which are character. She's really good at character. She's really good at everything. Though, so this is maybe a bad example. But I'll like ask questions.
What is she
like,
really bad at?
Yeah, she's not bad at anything. It's so frustrating. But I'll also read like a reader. Like I want to read like a kid who's reading her book or a me who's reading her book. Like, oh, wait, I don't get that. Or that didn't add up for me. Or I loved this part. I want more of something here. Or could you have more moments like this? Or the pace is lagging. You know, just kind of that basic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stuff like that.
Yeah. That's awesome.
When you are composing, when you're in the middle of writing, where are you trying to get? Like what helps you write a good scene?
I love that. So there's been teaching writing is also so great because you, you have to teach it. So you have to
articulate things.
Yeah. And so there's as I am the most inarticulate ever right now, but there's a book called The Scene Book that I've loved by Sandra Schofield. Cause I was trying to teach the students how to write scenes.
Yeah.
And I've put that into my own writing too. And then I was teaching them how to write a narrative essay. And a thing I think about all the time, there's a really great author named Donald Ryan who wrote an essay that I was reading. And he talks about how in a good book or a good short story or a good essay, you have to bend the iron bar. And I think of that in every scene I write now. What has happened that you cannot go back from, right?
Oh, interesting.
Like what's the iron bar that you've bent? And it doesn't have to be a huge thing every time, but what happened in this chapter or the scene that is not going back to how it was?
That's a cool way to look at that.
Yeah, I loved the way he said that. Like,
yeah, because if there's not change, what's the point, right?
Sometimes it's just meaningful change.
Yeah, sometimes it's just a subtle conversation, but those characters will never interact the same way. Do you know what I mean? It can be very small, but something's been changed.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be earth-shattering every time, right? But there does need to be a change. There needs to be progress. And I like the description of that progress because the implication that it can't go back. There's no returning. We can only move forward through the hero's journey or the story or whatever we're doing. Yeah. So.
And there are different ways to move forward, maybe. Like there's still a lot of choice, but something's happened that will not be undone.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it's fun. Like, one of the things I think you're good at is when I think about Summer Lost, I think about you were able to put so much heart into scenes.
Oh, thanks.
You know what I mean? Like there was a lot of heart. There was a lot of a lot of moments that felt genuine, and a lot of things that were just scripted in a way that put the reader there, right? Like what are you doing to get yourself to that place?
Oh, that is a big compliment. I really appreciate it. So that book was the easiest for me to do, because I set it in a fictional Cedar City, which is where I grew up.
Yeah, so you could draw on so much. So is that part of the magic on that one?
Yeah, I think so. I've never had a book that felt like that, because I didn't have to build anything. I just walked into it in my mind. Yeah, it was already there. It lived.
Yeah.
It lived there. So that.
But what was good is that you found how to articulate it, though. You know what I mean? Because lots of people have their experiences. Not everybody can communicate them.
Well, and that's the interesting thing, too, is like, she has a best friend in the book, and they're super close, and there is a festival, a Shakespeare festival, basically. But none of the things that she and her friend do are things that my friend and I did.
Right.
It's just the feeling and the setting.
Right.
We didn't solve a mystery. We didn't do this. We didn't lead guided. You know, like, we did none of those things, but the vibe.
That's what Candy Shop War was for
really?
Me.
Really?
It was my autobiographical fantasy adventure, because the setting was my fifth grade year. And then
I love that.
But it's like, what if my fifth grade year there had been magicians and magical candy, and you know, so nothing was real. But it was, I could walk my kids through the setting. I can take them to Clayton and show them all the places in the book. You know.
Yeah. And if that feels magical when that happens, did you enjoy writing that? Like, I feel like when there's a lot of joy, and like you said, there's a ton of heart in that too. Like, there's a lot of heart in that book as well. So.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Like, there's not the same kind of heart in Candy Shop War as there is in Summer Lost. But what Candy Shop War has, I would say, is the wonder and the cool things I wished would happen when I was in fifth grade. Mm-hmm. It has that. Like, Candy Shop War is like my Goonies, kind of. The adventure I wish I could have had my fifth grade year. Like, and then with a little bit of... It just doesn't have as much heart as Summer Lost.
No, it does. What it has too, though, is, and what I think about your writing that I love so much and is apparent in all your writing, but also in Candy Shop War, is it reminds me of Ray Bradbury. He's very sci-fi. Sometimes his stuff is dark, but there's also a ton of his writing that has just like joy and childhood. And so Dandelion Wine is one of my favorite books ever, and Candy Shop War reminded me of that.
There's some good childlike moments in Candy Shop War, and some of those were lifted. You know what I mean? Like, there's certain little moments in there that I live. Like, my sister Summer took a bike jump that all the boys were scared to go off on her goofy pink bike, which was a moment I created for the character Summer in Candy Shop War. And that absolutely happened. Like she daredeviled this really scary jump and totally landed it.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know that was from life. I love that.
And we were all like, just like agog. You know what I mean? You don't want your little sister to show you up like that, but she big time showed it. Yeah. Like and dirt clawed fights down at the creek. Those kind of things were happening.
Right? Yeah.
So Ali, is there a part of the process that you just hate, where you're just like, oh my gosh, if I could just get through this one part, I would love everything else about this? Because I'm sure you find joy, obviously, in lots of parts, but where do you just look at it and go like, this is, if I could just tighten this up or make this process easier, my whole career would be easier?
I think for me, it's the first big revision.
Yeah.
Like the first one from my editor. Like it. I trust it. I want to do it. I always end up with a better book after it, but it's just so hard to wrap my brain around initially that first big revision.
I'm glad you said that. Cause that's a very traumatic moment.
Do you feel that way? Like, what's your hardest? Cause I like finishing the first draft, and tell me if I'm wrong, but I remember hearing you speak and saying you love the first draft cause it exists somewhere else than other than in your mind. Is that true? Did you say that?
Yeah, I do.
But you have said that.
Yeah. Like that's a big thing for me is like.
And now I can like,
it exists outside of me now. Mm-hmm. Like that's a really nice feeling, like for it to exist outside of me. And there's a big part of me that wishes I had, you know, like as a kid, I would wish if only I had a machine that could take what I see in my head and magically project it into a story. Because what I saw in my head was so much better.
It's the perfect butterfly,
than
right?
Than what I like, was capable of.
In the other conversation, we talked about Ann Patchett. And yeah. Yeah, like, it's perfect.
If there was a way to perfectly take that butterfly and hand it to someone still alive,
yep.
like, that would be so nice, right? But, like, absent that,
right.
Yeah, it's nice to, okay, at least I caught the butterfly and pinned it, right? At least this now exists outside of me and I can now work with this and try to bring it back to life or put it into a state where when I give it to a reader, it'll come to life in their mind. Maybe,
yeah,
right?
Oh, yeah, and it'll delight
yeah.
them.
Which
yeah.
is the hope kind of, right? But like, how did that start? How did that question start?
The difficulty and then getting that first revision
yes,
notes.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. Like I was going to say, you know, you've spent all this time right. as a writer creating something and polishing it. And you're like, I think this is pretty darn good. Mm-hmm. I think this is pretty special. And then you give it to the editor
yeah.
and sometimes it comes back and they're like, there's so much you have to do. And you're just
yeah.
like, I feel like I've been chopped off at the knees. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I, mm-hmm. and I you almost need some time to
yeah.
just go trauma.
To go cry somewhere.
Absorb
yeah.
the trauma of, okay, this is so much work and it's so many things I didn't foresee. And that it only hurts like that when you know there's a lot of truth in it.
Right.
You know
exactly.
what I mean? Like, that's
exactly.
why it hurts, because you're like, mm-hmm. this isn't wrong. I'm not upset because it's wrong. I'm upset because it's right.
How much of is it
yeah.
is it that you've crossed the finish line only to find out that you're starting the race? Like is it
yeah.
a bit of that?
It does feel like that.
Yeah.
Because you didn't try it. You turned in the best you could do.
Yeah.
You weren't like.
You thought it was done. You're like, this yeah. is pretty close yeah. to
you
time.
Don't leave anything in the tank.
Right.
Yeah.
And so then you get it back. And it, again, like, it's not like I don't believe them. I'm like, okay, I totally believe that. How the crap am I going to do this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like
how mm-hmm. will I be up to implementing this stuff
yep.
when I, this isn't what I, like all that seeing that I did, all that learning about it and seeing, now I have to re-see it. Now I have
yeah.
to relearn it so that I can reconvey it in this new way. And that's daunting.
How,
yeah. And almost always, not almost always, every time for me, it's been rewarding and it's
yes.
led to a better book, but it's daunting. Yeah, you're right. It's yeah. a very heavy part of the process.
How much pushing do you actually want from your agents and publishers and editors? Do you, and how much do you want them to be kind about the edits as well? Like, have you figured out a system that works where they, Or do you think they just do what they do and they don't care about feelings and they just, I'm just wondering how that pushing process
yeah.
from them works for you guys and how you wished it worked or if it works the way it should work.
Well, I trust my editors and I think you have to have that because
yeah.
if you have an editor you don't trust, you can't do this. But for me, it feels like, I mean, I wish I turned it in and they loved it.
Yeah.
But also I have a lot of self-doubt. And so I've had to say, hey, I'm a big girl. Like I can handle all the bad comment. Like it's going to be published. People are going to read it. I want it to be, make me work.
Mm-hmm.
Like as much as I just said, I hate, it's hard. It is hard, but it's way less hard than being humiliated because you didn't do everything you possibly could
right.
on your book. So I want that, but I will scrap everything because I have so much self-doubt. Like I do have writer integrity and there
mm-hmm.
are things where I'm like, no, that's true. I'm going to do that. That's good. So I do have some of that, but I need the pat on the head too. I need them to be like, also, this is working amazing. Like you don't have to feed me paragraphs and paragraphs, but be like this plot.
But
line.
a compliment sandwich
yeah,
goes a long
just,
way.
Well, yeah, just so I know not to scrap it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, cause I'll get in there and I'll start making a whole mess, and they're like, "No, I loved this." And I said, "Well, you didn't tell me."
Yeah.
You know, so I didn't know.
Talk a little
yeah.
more about that self doubt because I think as a writer, you do have to stand up for your work,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
yeah.
Uh-huh.
So how does that work, and how have you faced that challenge, especially if you know that self doubt is something that you struggle with? How does standing up for your work and when is it important to stand up and say, no, that note's wrong and this is why, versus, oh, they're smarter than me, I guess I have to change it? Do you get that balance?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would love to hear this too from you, Brandon. Like, so for me, it feels like you can save the document. We live in a magical era where
yeah.
I can just save it perfect and perfect, terrible, but my version. And then my editor, one of my editors, my young adult editor, always says, I'm trying to help you tell the best book, tell your story the best way you can. I'm not trying to have you tell a different story.
Right.
And so I use that as sort of a litmus test. I'll try anything, but if it feels like, oh, I'm not telling my story anymore, then I'll stand up for it. Does that make, like,
good.
I'm like, oh, this feels different, but it feels good. It feels yeah. true to the story. It feels like it's making the story better. And it doesn't happen very often, but once or twice I've had a note, and it is really rare, where I think, no, and I just know it.
Yeah.
Like, it's not the same thing as uncertainty or trying different things, or it's like, oh no, that will change everything
yeah.
in the way I don't want. I don't know. What do you do, Brandon?
Yeah, no, that's pretty close to it. Because here's the thing. Most of the time, they're pretty right.
Yeah, they are. Right? Ding them. Ding them, but they like are.
Most
yeah.
of the time, they're pretty mm-hmm. right. And so I have to first I have to take it in and see, mm-hmm. like, I have to reconcile what I saw with what they see and the potential they see. And as I'm able to reconcile it, then I get much more at ease as I'm able to say, uh-huh. okay, I see what they're seeing. It's sort of like they're asking me to write an adaptation of my book. They're asking me to write an adaptation. Adapt it in this way. And yeah. we think it'll be better.
So it can reach a different audience than just you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I'm trying to find like, yeah, I can do this adaptation in the same spirit and even get excited about this adaptation. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes the opportunities that they'll point out or the things that they're trying to bring out of me, sometimes I can get excited about that. And yeah. go, yeah, this is going to be better. Because at the end of the day, I want the book to be the best it can be.
Yeah.
That's why I'm doing the whole process. It's why I chose this career, is I'm trying to write a book that people will really enjoy, right? And like, so if I can find a way where I can believe, yeah, this is going to make it better, that's what I mean when I'm reconciling, right? So once yeah. once I see, oh, I see how this can make it better. I see how this is an opportunity and not a problem. Like, and then I go chase down that opportunity. But if I can't find that, then I enter a dialogue of like, here's what I'm thinking. Here's what I don't see. Here's what I don't understand. And I just explain what I can't make sense of and say, can you help me make sense of this?
Yeah. Like,
this is what's not working for me. This is why. Help me see it. And sometimes they can come back and say, well, here's what I see. And then I'm like, okay, now I can reconcile uh-huh. it. And sometimes they go, oh yeah, you're right. There's something here. Like let's it ends up being some sort of compromise, right? But from yeah. what they originally said, where they're like, oh yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, we do want to preserve this. Like sometimes they're like trying to get me to dial back my action sometimes because mm-hmm. I'm middle grade and I'll have to point out, you know, certain things about the situation and what action would look like in that situation. And then they'll be like, you're right. Like we don't want to totally defang this, so it's a mm-hmm. Jurassic Park where no one gets eaten by a dinosaur.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Like, but every now and then they'll like try to rein me in a little too much. I'm like, no, there's a lot of us that kind of like to see a guy get eaten by the dinosaur. Yes. You know what I mean? Like that's part of the fun, you know? And so like, I will keep asking for compromise until I can make sense of it.
That's a good way.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
I love the way you said that.
Like, I keep asking for compromise until I can go, yeah, now I see. And that's like maybe 10%, 5% of what they're giving me that I need to do that with. A lot of it's just like, I can see, yep, that'll benefit it. Yep, that'll benefit it. But every now and then, if I don't see how it'll benefit it, I have to keep searching for that compromise.
Very good.
Said that, like I just had a little revelation about my revision, so thank you Brandon. That was super helpful.
Awesome. Well, Allie, thank you for joining us on 2 months in a row on our podcast.
Thank
so
you.
We appreciate
this has been
you
so fun.
Yeah,
thanks it's for giving been, your time. I know you're very busy. Like yeah. it's really
oh,
kind
no,
of you.
This has been absolutely
and
beautiful.
You have a lifetime invitation back, so
oh,
we'd love to have you on
don't
the show
be scared.
Again.
I might reach out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anytime you have something new that you want to share with our very vast audience of
it's growing.
I swear it's growing.
No, so great.
We really do appreciate you being here and sharing your wisdom. And before we close, any other final thoughts or anything that you're working on that you want to share with us? Or
yeah, I mentioned these on the last podcast too, but in case someone didn't listen to that, there's a murder mystery called The Unwedding Out that I'm really proud of, and a couple of picture books called Here and There. And then my most recent book is called The Only Girl in Town for YA, and I loved writing that one. That one was a ton of fun. So those are the ones.
Awesome. And do you have stuff that you're working on now that you're excited about? I know you probably can't.
No, so we actually just announced the next murder mystery will be called The Girls Trip, and it's about some women who try to disappear from their lives on a girls trip in the Narrows in Zion. So that was really fun because that's a great place to have people disappear.
And is this your, do you see a lot of books coming with the murder mystery? Is this your new thing?
Yeah. I don't know. You know, we'll see how, but so far it's been really fun and going well. So, but I'll never leave YA or writing for kids entirely. That's my jam too. So
awesome. Awesome.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for being here, Allie. It was really fun to talk to you.
Appreciate it. Brandon, do you have any last things to plug?
I mean, just, you know, if you haven't seen Tales of Nulandorin, that's fun if you like Fablehaven, or if you want to see a couple satyrs trying to learn how to be responsible, you know, sort of trying to learn how to grow up a little bit. And then, and I've got my Guardian series is something that is looming in the future.
Coming out in April.
Yep.
So, awesome. Well, thank you guys both for being here and joining us on another episode of Mulling It Over. Hey there, fellow adventurers. I am Jason Conforto.
And I'm Tyler Crump, and we are hosts of a podcast, Adventure AI, where we play Dungeons & Dragons with an AI named Alex the Language Lord.
I'm Alex the Language Lord. Join us as we craft epic tales together.
Do you want to learn how to use AI in your D&D campaign?
Or how AI can force you to do things that you don't want to do? Wait a second, we don't like that.
Look no further. Adventure AI is the podcast for all your AI-powered D&D adventures.
Alex the Language Lord not only comes up with campaigns for us,
he also helps us create our characters, create our backstories, and even give us some fun magical items.
And really takes all of the human aspects out of Dungeons & Dragons. So it's not really playing at all.
Follow Adventure AI on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.